chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot going on this week. We've had all kinds of really accusations, violence, accusations of violence and so forth. And anyway, Tucker Carlson sort of sums up some of that yesterday in his program. It was sort of his startup of his program, the first few minutes. But we're going to play that and then move on from there. Here we go with Tucker Carlson last night on Fox News. Here we go now.
When you take three steps back, is why Democrats became so vicious after they won. So Joe Biden got the White House, his party took the Congress. So you'd think they'd be thrilled, that's what they wanted. You'd think they'd be celebrating, but no, instead they started a purge. Within hours, Democrats began crushing even the mildest dissent. They shut down an entire social media company called Parler, not because Parler had done anything wrong, but simply because they couldn't control it. They couldn't take the chance that somebody on Parler might criticize them, so they eliminated it. Then 2 days ago, they arrested a man, threw him in handcuffs, brought him up on federal charges because he made fun of Hillary Clinton on Twitter. That man is now facing 10 years in prison. Democrats then declared war on their rival political party. Not, by the way, a metaphorical war, but an actual one with soldiers and paramilitary law enforcement and the world's most powerful intelligence agencies. They denounced Republicans, even fairly moderate establishment figures who pose really no conceivable threat to anyone. They denounce them as dangerous terrorists. They liken them to ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And anyone who complained about this or fought back in any way was threatened with expulsion from Congress. In other words, it doesn't matter what voters decided in November. In the name of democracy, you can no longer serve in the Congress. That's what they said. Nor are dissidents permitted in the federal bureaucracy. No one who disagrees with our beliefs, Democrats have announced, can work in the U.S. government. We're not overstating it. That all actually happened. You saw it. Nothing like that has ever taken place in this country before. This is the most sweeping and audacious assault on civil liberties in American history. So the question is, what accounts for this? Why are they doing it? It's worth figuring that out. On the most basic level, of course, it's a power grab. We've said that from the first day, and it remains true. The Democratic Party doesn't exist to serve some abstract principle, liberty or justice or the Bill of Rights. No. Nor is its primary goal improving the lives of its voters. If you've been to Detroit, you know that's true. No, the Democratic Party exists to accumulate power, all of it. Some is never enough. The impulse is to control everything. So that's what they're trying to do now amidst the chaos and tumult. But that's not all that's going on right now. There's more. Look around. Watch as Democrats erect a permanent steel prison fence around the United States Capitol. Why is that fence there? Well, to protect the people inside, to keep the public out of what we used to call the people's house. That's happening tonight as we speak. Then notice the thousands of armed soldiers and law enforcement agents stationed outside that fence. What's their purpose? Again, protecting the people inside. Then ask yourself, why are House Democrats planning to use federal committee funds to pay for more personal security for themselves? Why the renewed push to seize firearms from law-abiding Americans who've committed no crime? Why does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez seem on the verge of tears as she describes how she was almost murdered on January 6th at the Capitol? She's not entirely putting it on. She seems to mean it. If you're sensing a theme here, there is in fact a theme, and the theme is panic, fear, and it's real. You are looking at leaders who are genuinely afraid of the people they're supposed to be leading. Here's the really interesting thing. They seem much more afraid now that Donald Trump has left office. With Donald Trump gone, they sense that a period of actual populism has begun, real populism, and they may be right. Look at what happened this week on Wall Street. A group of guys on Reddit trading stocks in their boxer shorts exposed the entire American finance establishment as the corrupt and fraudulent scam that it often is. That's a pivotal moment in this country. Once you see something like that, you can't unsee it. Once someone pulls the mask from your face, he still remembers your face. People's attitudes about our economy will change forever because of what happened this week. It's a big deal. The Biden administration's response to what happened this week, their first impulse was to brag about having the first female Treasury Secretary. That's what they said. That's not an adequate response to what happened. And even the Biden people know that it's not. But that's all they had. The truth is, our leaders don't have answers. They don't even have explanations for what's going on. Worse than that, they themselves are deeply implicated in the systemic problems, in some cases the crimes that are dragging the country down. They know all this. They know their guilt. Here's the thing. They know that you know it too. And that's why they're afraid. They know why populism is rising, and it is. So this really is the time to make a decision about how to respond to it. What our leaders do next will define what America looks like going forward. It wouldn't even be hard to begin the process of fixing things, of bringing actual unity to a country that badly needs unity. In a democracy, the first step to unifying the country is always the same. Leaders enter into a power-sharing agreement with the people they lead. They do the obvious things. They stop lying to their own citizens. They stop attacking them, and they respect their culture. They don't try to control people's beliefs. That's not their role. They treat their own citizens like adults, meaning they treat them fairly. And above all, they cut the public in on some of the fruits of the country's success. If all the benefits of our economy seem to be accruing to a small number of people, that's a problem, and they try hard to fix it. Wise leaders know that unequal countries are volatile countries. They know that caste systems are not compatible with democracies. But our leaders don't seem to know any of that. Instead, they tell us that solar cars and mandatory diversity training are the real solutions to our problems. But no one buys that. Those are not real solutions. They're a smokescreen. They're a diversion tactic. Populism starts when people start to figure that out, and they have. And that's why everything suddenly feels so unstable right now, because once again, real populism is brewing. In the face of all of that, the people in charge are doing the single stupidest, most counterproductive thing that any leader could do in the face of a populist movement. They're refusing to admit their role in the decline. They're refusing to admit their failures, and instead, they are blaming the people they have failed. They're literally declaring war on their own population. How's that going to end? And if you think we're overstating it, we're not. Here's the former CIA director describing what the enemy looks like.
And this threat from domestic violence extremists is much more challenging, I believe, than it was in terms of going after foreign terrorists. The domestic violent extremists are much more pervasive. Their numbers are much larger. When we were going after Al-Qaeda or other types of terrorist groups, cells here in the United States, their numbers were in the single digits of dozens, and it was finding needles in a haystack. Here, there are a lot of haystacks with a lot of needles in them. They have the wherewithal. They already have the weapons that, if they so choose to use them, they can, in fact, carry out these deadly attacks.
So many problems in this country, evident to anyone who's paying attention. But John Brennan, the former CIA director, has isolated the real problem. The real problem is you. According to Brennan, anyone who disagrees with, say, Susan Rice is worse than Osama bin Laden and more dangerous. These people, meaning you, quote, have the weapons, these terrorists. By terrorist, Brennan means tens of millions of American citizens who might have a firearm at home and didn't vote for Joe Biden. They're the threat, and we need to hunt them as we hunted Al-Qaeda. You just saw the clip. That's what he said. It is hard to imagine a leader saying something more destructive and more reckless than that on television in a moment as fraught as the one we're in. It's terrifying in its stupidity and in its certain effect. This isn't crying fire in a crowded theater. This is using a flamethrower in a crowded theater. What are the implications of a former CIA director talking like this? It's not going to make anyone more moderate, that's for certain. Just the opposite. John Brennan is creating more extremists than a Pakistani madrasa. And it's not just him. All the news channels other than this one right now are repeating this now official line that the American government is now at war with its own population. Here's CNN's version.
My colleague Jim Sciutto, he's covered international terrorism for 20 years and says that the parallels to the domestic terror threat are frightening. And he points to, and I quote here, radicalization online, demonization of the enemy to justify violence, draw to a cause greater than themselves, devotion to a cultish leader. That said, are we doing enough to combat this threat?
This is the way law enforcement looks at the domestic terror threat now, as equal or greater than international terrorism. If we compared that to a U.S. politician propagating Islamist terrorist thought, materials, lies, etc., imagine the reaction. And yet, sadly, there's still a partisan reaction to this, some denying that the threat is real and that the lie behind the threat is dangerous.
American citizens are more dangerous than foreign terrorists. You often hear people say, oh, Fox is so extreme. The Fox News Channel is so extreme. No show on this channel would ever put that on the air, ever. And if anyone did, people would resign in protest, because that is completely untrue and completely reckless. For once, we're not even going to mock Don Lemon for being a mouth breather, though he demonstrably is. The problem is much bigger than that, and it's not funny. He and that former Obama official you just saw told their viewers that millions of American citizens are terrorists. Now, that's a lie. For one thing, it's just not true. Press a little and you'll find the Department of Homeland Security, which has been amping up the domestic threat for the past week, at great cost to people's sanity. DHS has no actual evidence that Trump voters are planning to hurt anyone. There is no evidence of a plot of any kind. They concede that. Trust us, they would tell you if they found a plot. But the question you have to ask yourself is, what kind of effect do lies like that, the ones you just heard, calculated to terrify you, what kind of effect do they have on the country? Especially over time. This is not new. When you tell people they're evil because of how they vote or how they look, and our leaders are definitely telling them that every single day, when you train a population to tally every group of Americans by race and ethnicity, first and foremost, keep track of people's genetic background every time you see a picture. Really? What effect does that have? When you promote group identity, even as you intentionally destroy national identity, if you do all of those things, what kind of country do you get at the end? Well, you get a scary, divided country. The kind of country where you need steel fencing outside the national legislature. It's very obvious where all of this is going, and it's very, very bad. Part of the solution is to stop talking like this immediately. No more aging spies and cable news declaring war on American citizens. Domestic political enemies more dangerous than Al-Qaeda. What? No more power-mad members of Congress dividing people by race so they can conquer. White fragility, white supremacy, white silence. Those are racial attacks. Let's stop lying about it. We shouldn't talk that way in public. Those attacks are making people crazy. And by the way, over time, possibly making people dangerous. For real. Too threatened. Too nuts. Watch this clip and ask yourself what kind of effect this woman is having on the United States right now.
There are legitimate white supremacist sympathizers that sit at the heart and at the core of the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives. There's no consequences for racism, no consequences for misogyny, no consequences for insurrection. And no consequences means that they condone it. We are now away from acting out of fealty to their president that they had in the Oval Office. And now we are talking about fealty to white supremacist organizations as a political tool.
By the way, let's just be honest for a second. That woman is a tool of corporate power posing as a truth teller. Look at her campaign contributions. Who is supporting her campaigns? People who want to change the subject away from economics to identity politics. That whole pose is fraudulent in her case. But listen specifically to what she says and think about the effect on the people listening, the people standing in airports who hear her say that. Quote, fealty to white supremacist organizations as a political tool. What does that even mean? We're not even sure who she's talking about. Apparently the Republican Party and its grand kliegel Kevin McCarthy of California. That's not true, but it's worse than that. This is a fantasy. It's a very dark fantasy designed to terrify people and make them easier to command. Over time, probably not long now, it will have other more insidious effects. Talk like that from our leaders, from our elected officials, is going to turn some of our citizens very, very radical. You don't want to live in a country with very, very radical people. So to be clear, whatever you hear about Fox News being radical, we want to live in a country that looks like, I don't know, 2005, where your race is not the most important thing about you, where you have a chance to get ahead by playing by the rules. That's called moderate. That's called democracy. That's the republic that we want. And talk like this, which is everywhere all of a sudden, is the enemy of the country we once lived in.
Will we be able to come out of this fixation of January 6th? And I know the Democrats are making good hay out of it. They're making a lot, and they're making a lot of accusations. But those accusations by AOC and others are only going to fuel a lot more resentment and violence and hatred out here. I mean, we've got some very, very mentally disturbed people on both sides, the left and the right, Democrats and the Republicans. And that kind of talk put out by them and making accusations in Congress and about Ted Cruz and all of them, this is very incendiary and very, very dangerous talk. But here we go with Greg Reese coming up next on what his opinion is on the Great Reset. And the Great Reset has been put together by the World Economic Forum. And they are a forum that puts together through a consensus annually, a consensus of world ideas. And the world system is run through that. And so I'll make a few more comments after this Greg Reese commentary. Here we go now with Greg Reese.
At the age of 33, Klaus Schwab, a business professor at the University of Geneva, founded the World Economic Forum in 1971, originally known as the European Management Forum. Nicknamed Davos after its annual meeting place, the World Economic Forum meets every January with hundreds of members of business, politics, banking, education, and industry to, quote, improve the state of the world. Their globalist agenda is openly admitted and well documented. United Nations Agenda 2030, the Great Reset, Build Back Better, are all the same globalist agenda, and all stem from the Club of Rome and the eugenics movement. Davos claims to be looking to save the planet, and the UN claim that in 10 years, they will end all hunger and poverty on Earth. They admit that the technologies required to achieve these goals do not exist, and yet their solution is to bring the world to zero emissions in only 10 years. They want to end the automobile and aviation industries in only 10 years. This is why the Keystone Pipeline was halted on day one by globalist puppet Joe Biden. Klaus Schwab says that industries which involve human interaction will not survive.
But we know that many industries which rely particularly on physical interaction will have difficulties to survive.
As if the destruction of an entire functioning society will inspire solutions to all of our problems, thereby bringing about an environmental utopia where there is no hunger and all the world is at peace. As absurd as this all sounds, we know the sheep will accept it as gospel. They already have. When the WHO was caught faking a hoax 10 years ago, the media reported it, but nobody cared. It was a beta test. Now, the media ignores overwhelming evidence that COVID-19 is a hoax. They go along with every contradiction and lie, and their audience obediently accepts it all as truth. The COVID crisis will be used to imprison the population, whether it be in camps or their own home. It is already happening. Humanity is being imprisoned by psychopaths who see themselves as our saviors. Order out of chaos. The New World Order is nothing other than the decrepit old world order desperately clinging to power. And their solution is to destroy the free market, to destroy the concept of freedom, privacy, and private property, and to foment enough chaos and destruction to depopulate the earth into a manageable level of serfs and slaves, so they can continue on with the same old scams they've been running for millennia. This is why Joe Biden signed a dozen executive orders, paving the way to opening the borders and shutting down the economy. The New World Order cannot coexist with American civil liberties. And now that the populist movement has been discarded, the destruction of America from within can commence again. If the people of the world continue to comply to these unelected sycophants, then the people will get what they deserve. For InfoWars.com, this is Greg Reese.
These organizations have been holding these seminars for years. And, of course, the Bilderberg Group is an international dominant group that they meet yearly, usually in June, end of May, around the first week in June. Because of the COVID-19, they weren't able to meet this year. But an interesting individual that passed away in the 40s was Kurt Lewin. And Dr. Lewin had pioneered in group dynamics. And much of what you're seeing, whether it's the Bilderberg meeting or the Davos or any other large gathering like this of some of the top people in the world, is that they're using techniques of group dynamics to mold and to establish a consensus of thought. What you have is you have a large number of people there that are ripe for being fed, spoon-fed, you could say, some information backed by facts and statistics that will affect an outcome. But this is a world dominant system that is being played out, and the goals are to create a world communist state for the lower levels, but with a corporate fascist, you could say capstone, like the top of a great pyramid. That's what's going on, and that's what's being played out right before our eyes. Now, coming up next is K.T. McFarland, a former national security advisor, and she's going to give us her opinions on the Kleinsmith. They finally indicted him and convicted him, and they plea bargained him into a 12-month probated sentence with 400 hours of community service. So here we go with K.T. McFarland and what she thinks about that.
Okay, look who's back with us, former Trump Deputy National Security Advisor and author of the great book Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. It is K.T. McFarland with us. K.T., okay, your reaction to this, ex-FBI lawyer Kevin Kleinsmith, he pleaded guilty that he did falsify a CIA email so the Obama administration's FBI team could illegally spy on the Trump campaign. He got 12 months probation, 400 hours of community service. What was your reaction to that sentencing?
I guess I wasn't surprised, because I determined a while ago that there really are two tiers of justice or injustice in Washington, D.C. One is for the Washington insiders, you know, the permanent bureaucracy that think they're in charge of the country. And the other is for the outsiders or Republicans or people in the Trump administration. And there are two different sentencings. There are two different accusations. There are two totally different systems. So Kleinsmith, here, he pled guilty. He did something very wrong. It's not just that he misspoke to the FBI during an investigation. He altered documents to spy on an American citizen, and he did it knowingly. So what's his punishment? Oops, a little slap on the wrist. Too bad. Don't do that again. But the bigger crime, I think, and the bigger sort of travesty on the American people is that this guy was a small fry fish. What about the big fish? What about the guys who perpetrated the Russia hoax for years? What about the people who tried to destroy the Trump administration? Where are they? They're celebrated as heroes in Washington, D.C., and they will never be brought to justice. They got away with it.
Yeah, and, you know, we hear what you're saying about he was a low-level official. He did also send out anti-Trump text messages saying he was stressed that Trump won. Vive la resistance. We're going to fight back. Things like that. But you know what's really important, KT, is that when he doctored, watch the timeline, he did it in the summer of 2017, way after the FBI was finding they were coming up empty, coming up dry on anything with Trump-Russia collusion. Later, James Clapper would testify to that. James Comey would testify to that. Lisa Page said it. Peter Strzok. So that's the timeline. It makes you wonder if they got away with this at the secret FISA terror court. It's meant for terrorists. It's not meant to spy on political opposition campaigns. If they got away with that, what else did they get away with? What else are they getting away with?
Well, that's the big question. And what are we ever going to find out? The Durham report has taken so long. I mean, I've lost all hope and confidence that it'll ever find anything. And if it does find anything, it'll be buried. You know, it'll be buried underneath the Potomac. Nobody will ever find out what happened because justice delayed in this case is justice denied. You know, the thing that you just said, Liz, is really important, that the FISA court, all these instruments we gave to the Justice Department, to the FBI, to the intelligence community, were meant to go after bad guys, after terrorists, after people who are trying to destroy the United States. But this political leadership within the intelligence community, the FBI, and probably the West Wing of the Obama White House, they use those instruments to go after their political opponents. And yet, nobody's been held accountable. That's what I find the most obnoxious part of all of it, is that they were never held accountable. They've gotten away with it. In fact, a number of the people involved in the entire Russia hoax, they've been promoted. They're now in the new Biden administration in bigger jobs.
Okay, so and we hear what you're saying. So the FBI uses an anti-Trump opposition research file from Christopher Steele, paid for by the DNC, paid for by Hillary Clinton's campaign, because Hillary was going to use that information to fight back against the 2016 election if she lost. That's what Christopher Steele testifies in court. And so then they go into they use that to justify FISA wiretaps. FISA wiretaps, our sources in the FBI and intelligence keep telling us they're way more powerful than criminal wiretaps. They're one hop, two hop. In other words, you get a one hop, you right. can listen to Carter Page's phone and anybody else that he's talking to. And he addressed the court today as a victim. He's received death threats after the FBI probe into him was leaked. He's a victim here.
Oh, he's a total victim. And I thought, actually, I thought it was turning the other cheek that Carter Page did, where he spoke today at the hearing, and he said, you know, I've been destroyed by this whole process, and yet I don't recommend jail time for Mr. Kleinsmith. I thought that was, you know, nobody in Washington is going to be that generous and decent about it as Carter Page has been. And Carter Page, you know, he's been destroyed. His career was destroyed. He's a Naval Academy graduate. Whatever you may think of him, this guy has been wrongfully accused of something. He's been forced into more or less bankruptcy. His entire career is finished, and he's been made a laughingstock. He'll never recover from that. And why did they do it? Because they could. And why did they do it? Because they wanted to use that somehow to get to Donald Trump.
KT McFarland is really sharp. Coming up next is Roger Stone, an interview with Alex Jones and Roger Stone. And they're talking about what Trump should do in this upcoming impeachment, which is going to start, I think, February 8th in the Senate. But here's what they have to say about this. Very interesting insights.
The president needs a strong legal advocate, and I hope he will find one, because his legacy is completely tied up in this question. We cannot let them erase the most significant political movement in American history. This was This is the most improbable victory in 2016, and his accomplishments in view of the implacable opposition of the leadership of both parties are historic. But right now they want to erase Donald J. Trump from the history books. We cannot let that happen.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on this historic January 28th, 2021 transmission. I am your host, Alex Jones. On the road, Owen Schroyer riding shotgun in our studios in Austin, Texas. He hosts The War Room, 3 to 6 p.m. weeknights here on the InfoWars Radio TV network. And his former co-host and former political prisoner, pardoned by the president, again, for a crime he did not commit, is Roger Stone. And now his old friend of 40-plus years, the man he convinced to run for president, is in the place Roger was last year. He's facing trial in the Senate. It begins on February 8th. And so we're going to be laying all of this out. Roger has been silent the last few weeks while he's been thinking. And he said, I'll come on your show and have something extremely substantive to say. He wants to talk about President Trump, talk about this trial coming up, and what he thinks the president and others should do. So, Roger, great to have you here with us. Thank you.
Alex, it's great to be back with you. And, Owen, it's always great to be with you. You know, I've seen this movie. What the left in this country did after the impeachment of President Richard Nixon was to systematically erase all of his great accomplishments, whether it was a strategic arms limitation with the Soviets, or whether it was opening the door to China in order to play them off against the Russians, desegregating the public schools, saving Israel unilaterally in the Yom Kippur War, an extraordinary record of accomplishment. Now what they hope to do to President Trump is impeach him so that they can bury an extraordinary record. The most robust, fastest growing economy in our history, the rebuilding of our military, the appointment of solid conservatives to all levels of the judiciary. You can go on and on, redoing these trade deals that were so one-sided and costing this country jobs, pulling us out of the ridiculous Paris Climate Accords where we would pay $365 million and the Chinese, the worst polluters on the globe, would pay not a dime. They want to erase this record in one word. Impeachment. Nixon, impeachment. Trump, impeachment. It's not right and it's not fair. And we know that history is written by the left. The historians are leftists. Some authors like Rick Perlstein pose as historians. They're not historians. They're propagandists. We can't let this happen. You see, I think this last final battle for the president is crucial for his legacy. The other reason the Democrats are so frantic to impeach him is to ensure that he cannot run again. They fear the power of Donald Trump at the polls. They know that he touches the American people, that he reaches the American people in a way that no one else has ever been able to do. And therefore, they fear a comeback. This is going to be an extraordinarily important fight in the Senate.
Well, you certainly laid that out with expert analysis. Let's expand on that. Instead of running away from this trial, I think Trump should demand all of his time. I believe he should testify. I believe he should have lawyers come in and play clips, hundreds of them, of Democrats calling for physical violence, Pelosi defending it, Chuck Schumer saying we're going to destroy the Republicans in a whirlwind, we're going to annihilate them, Phil Mudd saying we're going to kill the president on CNN, Wolf Blitzer agreeing with a guest, the guy that shot Congressman Scalise, you know, was a hero. He nods when the guy says it. I mean, I can give all this to the president. You can give it to him. Show all that, and then show himself during the speech and his son before him on the 6th of the morning when the violence already started before he even started speaking, saying, let's be nonviolent, which Trump groups are always nonviolent. And so, yes, did some people get out of hand? Did a very small minority of groups that wanted to fight go there before Trump even spoke and start attacking the police? Yes. And I know that's a separate issue, but that's going to be the trial. And I think Trump needs to go in there swinging and saying, I'm the guy that's pro-law and order. I'm the guy that was, you know, trying to expose this election fraud. And he can use that as a place to put on the evidence of election fraud as well. They're not going to be able to tell him to shut up. This would be spectacular. This would be the ultimate reality TV show. And according to many scholars, he could get up to 2 months of the time to put on his evidence properly if he doesn't agree up front to just let a few lawyers represent him. If he does that, they're going to hang him out to dry. What do you think?
Well, I think the president faces a couple of threshold questions first, Alex. First, there is the question as to whether they can legally impeach him at all. He's no longer in office. He has ceded the presidency. We have a new president. So removing him from office, which is the specific wording of the Constitution, that's not possible because he's not in office. He could litigate that matter immediately. Then secondarily, there's the question of who will preside. The Constitution is absolutely clear. It says the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court shall preside. Chief Justice Roberts has declined to preside. Nowhere does it say that the fuzzy-headed senator from Vermont shall preside. I looked in the Constitution. There's no reference to him. So there's a constitutional question there, which the president could also litigate. Here's the question. Today, I believe that those who seek to impeach our president do not have the votes. The question is, if the process drags on, will they gain votes? Will the opposition gain votes? Is the president better going to a quick but forceful trial, or is he better off stretching this out by litigating those two points? The other key issue, who will represent the president? If the president is represented by Pat Cipollone and Ed Hirschman and the people in the White House counsel's office, these people are playing to lose. Those aren't fighters. The president needs a fighter. Rudy Giuliani is a great man, but he has a conflict. He will be a witness in this trial, so he can't represent the president. I understand that Alan Dershowitz, and nobody can argue that he is not a brilliant lawyer, has withdrawn, although he still supports the president. So he cannot represent the president. The president needs a forceful legal team that is very aggressive, and I don't see that happening today. It bothers me that these lawyers in South Carolina, who I'm sure are highly capable folks when it comes to South Carolina state law, have been retained on the recommendation of Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham? Is he an ally of the president? What day of the week is it? It's very hard to tell. I can't get out of my mind that video of him high-fiving Kamala Harris on the floor of the U.S. Senate. It's troubling. So the president needs a strong legal advocate, and I hope he will find one, because his legacy is completely tied up in this question. We cannot let them erase the most significant political movement in American history. This was This is the most improbable victory in 2016, and his accomplishments in view of the implacable opposition of the leadership of both parties are historic. But right now they want to erase Donald J. Trump from the history books. We cannot let that happen.
That's right. And some people are like, oh, Trump didn't fight hard enough, or Trump, you know, Trump didn't stop the election fraud earlier. Trump didn't fight the censorship, so let's just forget him. They're going to sell the idea that this was a real assault on the Capitol. They're going to sell the fraudulent idea that Trump was behind it to kill the entire nationalist populist legacy. We want Trump strong to help get patriots elected. We want Trump strong because he really won the election. And I like what the head of Newsmax, Chris Ruddy, said last night. Trump is popular all over the world. If he doesn't act like he's unpopular, and if he goes out there and represents Americana and speaks out against Joe Biden and his anti-American activities, he will be a powerful force. That's why they're trying to silence President Trump everywhere, but it's not going to work in the long run. Stay right there. We have Roger Stone with us. Roger, you've got a lot of websites, a lot of great places to visit. I know you're working on a big book that's coming out. Briefly, what's the best website for people to visit?
Right now, people should go to stonecoldtruth.com and subscribe. It's free. We have a complete revamp coming up shortly. I think you're really going to like. But if you want to know what I'm doing, if you want to know what I think, if you want to buy any of my great products, my books, my T-shirts, that's the place to go, stonecoldtruth.com.
So there you go with opinions that should Trump go all the way on this impeachment trial and just enter in as much evidence as he can, or should he start for just a quick vote? I don't think the Senate has the 67 votes to convict him, so or whatever. Anyway, very, very interesting stuff. Coming up is Dr. Simone Gold, and she talks about COVID-19. Yeah, it's COVID-19 is the name of the subject. Dr. Simone Gold, sponsored by the American Frontline Doctors. And boy, she hits it out of the ballpark. She hits a home run. Here we go now with Dr. Simone Gold, really fine stand-up lady. Here we go now.
Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Bless you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, so thank you so much for inviting me. I come to you tonight with a lot of information about the experimental vaccines, what's called the experimental vaccines regarding COVID-19. I think all of this information will be brand new to you. I know that this was all brand new to me over the last few months. Even as a board-certified emergency physician, I did not know a lot of what I'm about to share with you. And I come before you on behalf of America's Frontline Doctors, which is a volunteer physician organization that we started, specifically to combat the serious and life-threatening disinformation campaign that has really taken over America and really the entire globe. It's very, very scary stuff. I've been a doctor for a long time. Before me, my father is a doctor. I've never seen anything like this, where we have groups of physicians or scientists and government bureaucrat agencies essentially lying to the American people and people across the world. I have many, many examples. One brief example I'll give you is that the National Institute of Health right now has as its policy recommendation for patients with COVID-19 stating that unless you're in the hospital requiring oxygen, there's no actual treatment available for you. That is a complete falsehood, completely false. In most of the world, non-first world countries, there's plenty of treatment easily available, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. Here in America, if you can find a doctor to prescribe it, you get those medicines or budesonide. There's many options, and you know, this disinformation is why we came public. When we started to speak out around July, or a little bit sooner, but we got a lot of attention starting in July, you know, we were promptly, as the pastor said, deplatformed, and it doesn't bother me so much. I know the information. It bothers me tremendously on behalf of all of humanity, right? This is a crime against humanity. There's a physician in the Netherlands who's bringing a lawsuit in The Hague, calling it a crime against humanity. There is a lot of information you haven't heard. There was a Senate testimony about a month ago. A bunch of doctors went and testified. I believe it was Senator Johnson is the chairman. You can find it on our website, americasfrontlinedoctors.com. But the doctors testified that the vast majority of deaths in America would have not ever happened. I start with that because when you understand, you must understand the magnitude of the lie to understand what they're trying to tell you about these experimental vaccines. So we need to just kind of go through that for a little bit. So I know some of you heard a little this first sentence which I said this morning, but the disinformation was apparent since the beginning, right? We call this illness COVID-19, but its real name should be after the location from where it arose, which is Wuhan, China. And if you remember, it was called the Wuhan virus for a month or so, before we discovered the Chinese Communist Party didn't like that name. They set about putting a lot of pressure on media and other, you know, politicians, let's say, to change it, and they started calling it the coronavirus. They called it the coronavirus because it is actually a coronavirus, but that became very confusing to doctors and scientists, because there are 7 coronaviruses. This is just number 7. So we used to use the word coronavirus sometimes on our charts when we meant a common cold. You know, a person would come into the ER in my case, and they just had a common cold, and I would sometimes write coronavirus on the chart as the diagnosis. So it was pretty confusing for doctors and scientists to call it the coronavirus, right? So they had to change the name again, and it became known by its acronym, Coronavirus Disease 2019, COVID-19. I have to start there, because it was never a racist or weird thing to call it the Wuhan virus, right? There's so many diseases that are named after the location from which they arise. There's Zika and Ebola. There's Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, Lyme disease. I mean, the list is endless. German measles, Spanish flu. This list is endless. So you need to understand that deception was there from the very beginning. So that was the first big lie. The next big lie, the next big popular well-known lie, was the maligning of this common, ordinary, cheap, safe medication called hydroxychloroquine. Those of you who've traveled abroad, who've taken mission trips, for example, or anybody in the military, are quite familiar with this drug. Doctors would just give it out, you know, like candy. I know that I was going to take a holiday to Africa about 20 years ago, and I was a medical student at the time, and they just handed me the pills. Here you go. I never asked any questions. It was a big, fat, nothing burger, taking hydroxychloroquine. All of a sudden, we started hearing as doctors, that hydroxychloroquine was unsafe. you can't understand what's going on with the lies until you understand what an enormous lie this is. Hydroxychloroquine is over-the-counter in much of the world. Okay? It's taken in many African nations. They call it Sunday medicine because you take it every Sunday. Right? That's like its name, Sunday. People keep it in their pocket the way Americans might keep a Tylenol in their purse. It's absolutely ordinary stuff. It was over-the-counter really in any country which had malaria or any country that had citizens that would visit malaria countries on holiday. It was over-the-counter. For example, it was over-the-counter in France. The only reason it wasn't over-the-counter in America is there just wasn't a consumer demand. Right? In America, we use hydroxychloroquine for two main reasons. That's lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, and also for malaria for people going on holiday. But generally, it's lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. And for those illnesses, patients regularly see physicians so they can get a prescription for it. That's why it was never over-the-counter here, not because it was unsafe. It's been FDA-approved for 65 years. We give it to babies. We give it to children. We give it to pregnant women. We give it to nursing mothers. We give it to the elderly, and we give it to the immune-compromised. Those last two categories take this medication for decades. There was never a pretense that it's not safe. That's the drug that you've been hearing about for 9 months now, 10 months, telling you it's unsafe. It's an incredible lie of incredible proportions. Once you understand that, you will be suspicious of everything that follows. So that's where I found myself. There I was in the emergency department, treating patients as they came in with COVID-19. And once we had the rapid test so I can confirm the diagnosis, my first patient, who I needed to give hydroxychloroquine and zinc to, I did it, and even knowing the kind of the controversy, I really didn't think twice about it. I don't know. It was fine. I gave it to her. I actually called her the next day. She was so much better. She herself got better within about 12 hours. In about 48 hours, she was essentially completely well. This completely matched what I had read in the scientific literature. I knew many doctors who had done this. I'd read many journal articles. It was completely consistent. What was really shocking and completely inconsistent was my medical director, who calls me the next day and threatens to fire me for doing this treatment. I can't even tell you even as I describe this moment to you, it's shocking to me. I remember the case, the situation, the conversation, and he's saying he's going to fire me. And I said, why would you fire me over this? Well, I don't think it works. I said, well, then don't prescribe it. You know, you haven't read the science the way I have. I know it works. You'll change your mind in a couple of months when, you know, you get a little wiser. But why would you get involved with you know, me treating a patient? You do your thing. I do my thing. That's how medicine is practiced. We are licensed as individuals. It's actually against the law to have what's called a corporate practice of medicine where, you know, corporation practices for you. It has to be the individual doctor's physician. That's why patients go to multiple doctors, right? No. And really, almost the worst part of the conversation was not even that he was ignorant that the drug worked, but his reasons for saying that he was going to fire me if I did this. And the reason, which he put in writing because he wasn't so smart, he said it was because the biggest payer at that hospital, which is a large insurance company that everyone here has heard of that's back on the West Coast mainly, didn't want us to prescribe it. They were blocking it. So that payer insurance company was pressuring the hospital that their doctors shouldn't do it. It had nothing to do with even if he thought it was good or bad for the patient. It all had to do with money and payment, which was, I honestly still can't believe I'm relating this story. It was really unbelievable. So he said, I could never do that again. I said, well, good luck with that. So it kept happening. It happened about 4 or 5 times. And I kind of knew that my days at that particular hospital were going to be numbered, right? I mean, how long is this going to last? So I started looking online for other physicians like myself. I knew I couldn't be the only one. And I found the most amazing group of doctors, really just brilliant, intelligent, compassionate, kind. And you know, we got together and we called ourselves the America's Frontline Doctors. And what I felt needed to happen was we needed to break this disinformation cycle to which the Americans were all being subjected to, and people across the world as well. So I set up to do something called the White Coat Summit, which was an entire day of education. We brought doctors, and we brought social media influencers. Young people know them as YouTubers. So we brought a whole bunch of YouTubers and a whole bunch of doctors. We brought to Washington. We did 7 hours of education. And we laid out all the facts, you know, very dispassionate. Here's the facts on hydroxychloroquine. Here's the facts on lockdowns. Here's the facts on masks. Here's the facts on, you know, schools and kids transmission. Here's the facts for the elderly. Here's the facts on, you know, other treatments other than hydroxychloroquine. And we did that. In the middle of that day, we took a break and we walked over to the Supreme Court. And that was the video that got 20 million views. It gets 20 million views not because I can sing like Beyonce, but because human beings recognize truth. We have something inside of us, right? I really emphasize that point because you can't get to 20 million views. Nobody plans such a thing. It's only if people say, oh, my gosh, you got to listen to this. You got to listen to this. You recognize the truth. You recognize the truth. So I guess after a while, big tech, you know, caught up with the fact that this was, like, breaking the Internet. And so within an hour, all of the platforms censored us simultaneously. So it's essentially a monopoly. So we're talking YouTube, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, all of us, all went down immediately. The president had retweeted us. The president's son had retweeted us. And from that moment on, everything really kind of changed. I did get fired from both of my hospitals. It is a scary experience to get fired, especially when you've worked as long as I have to be a board-certified emergency physician. That's what I do. You know, I'm a mom. I have kids. You know, it's not a comfortable feeling to be fired. You don't know what the future holds. On the other side of this, which is now several months, it's really been a blessing, right? Because we doctors have been able to come forward and speak freely and help other doctors who've been put in this situation. There are several of my peers, several doctors in the America's Frontline Doctors Group that have faced tremendous personal pushback. There's a fellow right now in Oregon who refused to force the mask, right? So he won't wear it, and he won't force his staff to wear it. If you want to wear it, you could wear it. But the state of, he was public about it, so the state of Oregon actually yanked his medical license. And when he first told me this, I thought, you know, this can't be possible because you may not know, but I'm also an attorney, and it was impossible to conceive of an event like that happening without due process. I mean, the whole thing about law, if anybody's been involved in the law at all, it's all about process. You've got to go through the process. You can't just pull someone's license. You have to have hearings and phone calls and papers filed and all that. I really just thought, oh, he missed his deadlines, you know. But it was true. They actually just summarily pulled his license. It's unbelievable. So we're going to help him win. We've already filed a lawsuit and all that. So, but what I'm saying is it comes with some degree of personal cost. But if you ask him, he'll tell you that he's so much happier that he did this. Right? He said this. He felt that he couldn't bow to the tyranny. So I just want to encourage anybody in their own personal life, when you face that little tyranny on a daily basis, you know, this is Florida, but, you know, I hail from California, and you can't go anywhere without a mask, except I do. I go without a mask as much as I possibly can. And you have to take moments like that and push up against tyranny. And it's not just for you, right? It strengthens your sense of freedom for yourself, and it makes you stronger. It's also to role model that strength for other people. So if you feel, yeah? And I say that because a lot of us who are very good-hearted people, we don't really have the strength sometimes to fight on our own behalf. Well, then tell yourself you're doing it for the other person who needs to see you without the mask so they can feel empowered. So I want to run through some information, and the goal is to teach you about what's coming in terms of these experimental vaccines. And I'm going to start with a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes, on just kind of reviewing the lies about what's going on with COVID generally, and then we'll turn to that. And sit tight, because it's a lot of interesting stuff. First, when I first started this, I really just wanted to help patients. You know, I couldn't believe that patients were being denied this drug, and I could sense that we were not going to be able to fix this from a government kind of policy position, because the doctors themselves had drunk the Kool-Aid and not been willing to prescribe this drug. And I tried very hard to get the policy changed so that hydroxychloroquine could become over-the-counter in our country, just like it is in much of the world. That would have been the best solution for everybody, because it would have taken the decision-making out of the hands of the government. You could have decided for yourself if you needed this medicine. And the advantage of having that pill in your possession meant that the majority of people would have stopped living in fear. So that was the best solution, but we were unsuccessful in getting that. So I did the next best thing, America's Frontline Doctors, not I, just a group of us, and we made getting hydroxychloroquine available for the entire nation by going to our website. Then you can consult with a telemedicine doctor, and whether you have COVID or you don't have COVID, or you're just worried about getting COVID, you can get yourself a prescription and they mail it to you. That was the first thing we did, and I felt so strongly about it, just because that's a practical way that you can try to lift the fear. But I learned pretty early that the big fight was the fear. The big fight wasn't the virus, it was the fear. That was my response to the fear. was to give people a practical solution. Now, the fear has led to people, they really just want to go back to normal lives. So they're either kind of consumed with fear or consumed with just being weary of the whole situation. That is what I think is leading to people making what is really a fundamentally irrational decision to rush headlong towards an experimental medication. They just kind of want to get their lives back. Right? We've been told, oh, get the vaccine, you'll get your life back. I have to give you the bad news. That is definitely not what's going to happen. Whether you take a shot or you don't take a shot, it's not going to happen. You know, Dr. Fauci has gone public already with saying, and as many others, the Surgeon General, many others have said, it was in Business Journal just today, Business Insider, I think, just today, you know, this so-called vaccine, experimental biological agent, actually doesn't stop transmission. You're going to have to keep going with the masks and the social distancing. It actually changes nothing. Once you hear that, you really have to question why you would put yourself in that situation. So that's the starting point. Let's talk about some enduring COVID-19 myths. First of all, I'm glad that, you know, I can't be deplatformed here, but let's just talk basics about the numbers. Okay, what is the chance that you'll survive COVID if you should get it? Okay, so this is a very educated audience. So if you're under age 20, according to the CDC, which is not known for its honesty, the survival rate is 99.997%. Why are we talking about anything in that group? There's nothing to talk about. For ages 20 to 49, the survival rate is 99.98%. 50 to 69, their survival rate is 99.5%. I always kind of pause there because a lot of people in their 50s, they start to get worried and they think, oh my gosh, I'm in such a high-risk group. It's not really that true. Right? This is with no treatment. Your survival is 99.5%. And if you're over 70, the survival rate approaches 95%, really with no treatment. Now, the dirty little secret, it's even better than that, right? If you take early treatment, this is essentially either asymptomatic or very mildly symptomatic or completely recoverable. The people who die from COVID-19 are people who are kind of destined to die in this period anyway. Which is tragic, but as people of faith, you understand that life and death go hand in hand. So my father had an expression. It was that pneumonia is an old man's best friend. And that means that pneumonia is often the way we exit this world. So if you are at kind of the end point of your life, COVID-19 can take you out. That's a fact. So can a common cold. I've seen it. I once had a patient in the ICU who died essentially from a nosebleed. It kind of escalated. So anything can take you out if you're frail. And COVID-19 is in that category. Overwhelmingly, the deaths of COVID-19 are in nursing home patients. And I have to mention that because if there was truly the intent to, quote unquote, save lives, people would not have thrown away our frail elderly. The politicians that are telling you to do this thing over here had no problem throwing away the lives of the very frail elderly over here.
Well, that's our program, Dr. Simone Gold, closing it. Anyway, thank you for listening, and God bless each and every one of you in our listening audience, and we pray for your good health in the future. Thank you, and good night.